Earlier today, I gave this presentation to the students, and I told them I was going to give them a quiz question when I wrapped it up. I'm going to be a little easier on you. I'm going to give you your riddle now, lest I be a bit anticlimactic at the conclusion of the talk. I'm going to be speaking to you about the Aztec Indians, also commenting about the Maya Indians, having human sacrifice and cannibalism. Here's your riddle. I don't want anybody to lose any sleep over it. Cannibals traveling through the jungle in company with three priests. Three priests, three cannibals. Cannibals are not quite altogether converted. We want to make sure they don't lapse back into cannibalism. You can never leave more cannibals with fewer priests, or you will have served up dinner. They come to a river. There's a dugout canoe. Only two can cross the river in the canoe at a time. Nobody's allowed to swim. There's no tricky equations here. There's no easy answers. The river is filled with piranha. I've got to make these things very clear to the students when they try to figure out an easier way to solve the riddle. You can have any combination of cannibals or priests going across in the canoe by twos or by one to bring the canoe back and forth, but you got to get all of the priests and all of the cannibals over to the other side of the river without ever leaving on either side of the river shore more cannibals than priests. Mind you, your Catholic missionaries are relying upon your answer. Now, with no further ado, getting on to the serious nature of the business at hand, the original Indians of Mexico were the Toltecs. The Aztecs only invaded around the year 1200. They established Tenochtitlan in 1325. At first, the Aztecs were a very weak tribe, but they took advantage of their establishment upon Tenochtitlan in order to make war on surrounding tribes and having an area to retreat to. Tenochtitlan is in the 50-mile-long Lake Texcoco, saltwater lake, a group of small islands upon which the Aztec Indians brought out more turf and they hurled it up on the islands in order to build up more of a solid foundation, and they have three causeways coming out to Tenochtitlan. And so from Tenochtitlan, they were able to go out, battle with others, and scurry on back to their main base. Now, there were a couple of expeditions to Mexico, actually to the Yucatan, southeast of Mexico, prior to Cortez. Firstly, 1517, three ships, 110 men, under Francisco Hernandez de Cordoba. They landed, they were refilling their water casks, they were attacked by Indians, and they scarcely survived with their lives, and no water to show for the trouble. They continued on, they came to some pagan temples. There were clay idols made of pottery with the faces of demons or women and other evil figures, and showed Indians committing acts of sodomy with each other. They again were trying to gain fresh water, take on fresh water. They were attacked, and they were very difficultly dealing with their defense in the midst of a swarm of locusts. 50 soldiers were killed. Cordoba himself received no less than 10 wounds. They sailed back to Cuba, and Cordoba died within a few days. The following year, Juan de Grijalva came with four ships, 240 men. They were sailing along the coast when they spotted a woman flagging them down frantically. They took her aboard. She was a Jamaican who had been enslaved by the Indians. She, along with her husband and 10 others, had been blown up on the Yucatan shore, and all of the others had been cannibalized. The third expedition was planned for the following year with Hernando Cortez. Actually, it was being planned even prior to the return of Juan de Grijalva. Cortes at the time was 33 years old. Now let's talk a little bit about the Aztec Indians, because we also have to understand the religion. Now again, we talked about the lake upon which Tenochtitlan is established. Here is the freshwater lake, Lake Chalco. Now, the Indians in establishing Tenochtitlan have a population here of 300,000. There are 114 languages throughout the Aztec Empire, 51 of which are sufficiently widespread. The language of the Aztec Indians, Nahuatl, was known as a second language to the majority of the Indians. However, there are still millions of Indians who do not know Nahuatl. The Aztecs eventually established tribute with 371 towns and cities subjugated to them. Every religion, every false religion, has to have its own heresiarch, its own individual who establishes the religion. The Aztec religion was concocted by a great warrior by the name of Tlacaelel. Tlacaelel, at the age of 31, had established his leadership through wars. And he established this pagan religion, which was based upon human sacrifice, so that they always would have to have wars being fought to keep the Aztec warriors in fit condition for warfare and in order to take prisoners of war for human sacrifice. Infants also were sacrificed, even infants as young as 2 or 3 years old. Now, the ultimate climax of Tlacaelel's life was in 1487, when at the age of 89 years old, he dedicated the temple in Tenochtitlan to Huitzilopochtli, the principal Aztec god, the god of war. The temple had apartments for the priests, the pagan priests, and here let us read of the dedication of the temple. 80,000 human sacrifices. Well before daybreak of the opening day, legionaries prepared the victims, who were put in close single file down the steps of the great pyramid, through the city, out over the causeways, and as far as the eye could see. For the average person viewing the spectacle from his rooftop, it would appear that the victims stretched out in lines to the ends of the earth. The bulk of unfortunates were from hostile provinces and the swollen ranks of slavery. On the pyramid's summit, 4 slabs had been set up, one at the head of each staircase for Tlacaelel and the 3 kings of the Triple Alliance, all of whom were to begin the affair as sacrificial priests. All were in readiness. The lines of victims were strung out for miles, with great reservoirs at their ends, thousands of trapped humans milling about like cattle, awaiting their turn in the line that was about to move. Suddenly, the brilliantly arrayed kings appeared on the platform, and silence fell over the city. Together they approached Huitzilopochtli's chapel and made reverent obeisance. As they turned to join their aides at the 4 slabs, great snake skin drums began to throb, announcing that the lines could now begin to move. Relays of priests dispatched the victims. As each group tired, others of the thousands who were to live below in the new temple stepped forward to relieve them and keep up the pace. Years of practice had given them a skill and speed almost incredible. Reliable evidence indicates that it took only 15 seconds to kill each victim. Blood and bodies cascaded in an endless stream down the temple steps. Hearts were assembled in piles and skulls in racks. It went on for 4 days and 4 nights. More than 80,000 men were killed. Tlacaleu had commanded all the high nobility of Mexico to be present, watching from scented, rose-covered boxes. But eventually, the bonds of custom and even of fear were burst by overwhelming horror, and most of the spectators fled, along with many of the people in the city. Even those who could hide from the sight of what was happening were unable any longer to endure the stench. But Tlacaleu, at 89, remained to the very end, watching the victims killed at 15 seconds per man, until the last of the 80,000 had their hearts torn out before his devouring eyes. The principal god of the Aztecs was the god of war, Huitzilopochtli. The secondary god was Tezcatlipoca, the smoking mirror, lord of dark, god of phantoms and monsters, demiurge of creation, he who is at the shoulder as the tempter. The Spanish soldiers would simply call Tezcatlipoca the god of hell. Now, every Aztec town had its temples. And let us read a bit more to understand about the nature of sacrifice. The priests wearing once white garments were covered altogether with blood, which was blackened in being clotted and dried. Their garments were black. Their arms were black with blood. Their long black hair was covered in clotted blood. And from the victims, the limbs of the bodies were set aside and later cannibalized, both by the Aztec priests, also by the Aztec Indians, and also to wild animals that they kept, pumas, jaguars, fox, snake. There are several other events taking place in the very year 1487. Hernando Cortez was born in 1487, the same year that the dedication of the temple of Huitzilopochtli was taking place. Queen Isabel of Castile, Spain, was 36 years old. In her prime, it would be she who would send Columbus to discover the New World. And there was, close by Tenochtitlan, living not many miles distant, a 13-year-old boy, Cuauhtitlahuac. He was of the despised Mexican poor, the Mazahualtin. 40 years later, he would be baptized, exchanging his name, Cuauhtitlahuac, for Juan Diego. We see, therefore, already in divine providence, the preparations are being made for Our Lady to appear as Our Lady of Guadalupe. The expedition of Cortez counted 617 men, 12 of whom were cavalry, 10 small cannon, 13 musketeers, 32 crossbowmen. The majority relied on spears and swords. The banners of the expedition were blessed black velvet with a cross emblazoned in red, blue, and white flames, and the motto of Constantine, "Let us follow the cross, and in that sign we shall conquer." The expedition was placed under the protection of St. Peter. Mass was celebrated by the chaplain, Father Bartholomew de Olmedo. The expedition came to Cozumel, where they ransomed from captivity under the Indians a cleric in minor orders, Jerome de Aquilar. Aquilar had been in captivity by the Indians for 8 years, and therefore he had learned Mayan. He had been shipwrecked with some 15 sailors, all others being cannibalized except for himself and one other, the one other having turned renegade Now they had an interpreter, one who spoke both Spanish and Maya. They continued up to the river Tabasco. Cortez requested to land his 11 ships on the shore. There were 40,000 Indians there who replied in the negative. He was not one to take no for an answer. So they had mass aboard ship, the Feast of the Annunciation, and then came to attack with the Battle of Cintla. Let us read. As Cortez made a bold flank maneuver, leading the small cavalry, wielding his double-bladed iron sword. It was not long before the ears of the Christians were saluted with the cheering war cry of San Diego and San Pedro, and they beheld the bright helmets and swords of the Castilian chivalry flashing back the rays of the morning sun as they dashed through the ranks of the enemy, striking to the right and left and scattering dismay around them. The eye of faith, indeed, could discern the patron saint of Spain himself mounted on his gray war horse. The battle was won. Cortez kept his principal goal of breaking down the idols, erecting crosses, and instructing the Tabascan Indians. Palm Sunday was celebrated with all of the soldiers carrying palms. The Tabascan Indians gave for the service of Cortez an 18 or 19-year-old woman who was of the Aztec royalty, the Pipiltan. She, disliked by her stepfather, had been turned over to the Tabascan Indians. She was baptized by the name Marina, and because of her royalty, respectfully called Donna Marina by the Spaniards. She had been raised knowing the Aztec language, Nahuatl. She had been raised some years among the Tabascan Indians, therefore having learned Maya. Cortez now had two translators. And through the whole 2.5 years of the expedition, the manner of translating would be for Cortez to give Spanish to Aquilar, who translated into Maya, Marina translating the Maya into Nahuatl. And so indeed, it was a very unique and a very complex manner of spontaneous translation. Around the end of May, Cortez was contacted by the Totonac people of Sempoala to go just a bit north. They were asking him to assist them to regain their freedom against the Aztecs. They only recently had been subjugated by the Aztecs, and they wished to be liberated of giving not only the tribute of tax, but of seeing their wives, their sons, their daughters taken for sacrifice and slavery. At about the same time, the tax collectors came from Montezuma to Sempoala, and Cortez sent them back with a message of conciliation to Montezuma. Emissaries also came from Montezuma to Cortez bearing gifts, a basket of gold and silver ornaments, boxes of pearls, two large gold plates. But Montezuma did not wish for Cortez to come to Tenochtitlan. Cortez established his main base, Veracruz, the full name of which, Villa Rica de Veracruz, rich town of the Holy Cross, known as Veracruz, True Cross. He took possession of Mexico in the name of King Charles of Spain. He sent a letter back to King Charles of Spain in one of his 11 ships. And he describes, along with a letter sent by the Cabildo Council of Veracruz, the manner of sacrifice, most horrid and abominable custom, which truly ought to be punished, and which until now we have seen in no other part of the world. And this is that in the presence of the idols, they open the chests while they are still alive and take out their hearts and entrails and burn them before the idols, offering the smoke as sacrifice. Cortez left a third of his troops to guard the fort at Veracruz. But lest anyone might be tempted to make an easy retreat back to Cuba, he found the ships no longer to be of necessity, and so he torched 10 of them. Excuse me, 9. There's one left, if anybody has any misgivings. 1 went to Spain, 9 are torched, there's one still there. With the ships aflame, Cortes addressed his troops. As for me, I have chosen my part. I will remain here while there is one soldier to bear me company. If there be any so craven as to shrink from sharing the dangers of our glorious enterprise, let them go home in God's name. There is still one vessel left. Let them take that and return to Cuba. They can tell how they deserted their commander and their comrades, and patiently wait till we return. The address in response from the soldiers was en masse, on to Mexico. No one stepped forward to claim the last ship, so therefore, it not being needed, it also was torched. The army set out on August 16th, 1519, and Cortes, firstly, went through the land of Tlaxcala, being advised that the Tlaxcala Indians might easily ally with him since they had maintained independence from the Aztecs for 100 years by continual warfare. Tlalocalli could have easily crushed the Tlaxcala resistance, but mind you, Tlalocalli needed to have continual warfare in order to have continued prisoners to offer in sacrifice. And so they just kind of kept this war going without ever intending to bring it to conclusion. Cortes came to the Tlaxcala territory. He was not trusted by the Tlaxcalan Indians, having allied himself with the Cempoalan Indians. The Tlaxcalans expected perhaps it was a trap and that he was allied with Montezuma through the Cempoala Indians. And so he, in entering into the Tlaxcala territory, was attacked. On August 31st, 3,000 Tlaxcalans attacked the Spaniards fruitlessly. The next day, 6,000 attacked in a prolonged battle. On the next day, the Tlaxcalans brought up their entire army of 50,000 Indians for the next morning's attack. The priests, the two priests of the expedition, heard the soldiers' confessions through the entire night, preparing for death. On the morrow, the Tlaxcalans attacked, only half of whom were really fighting in full vigor, the others expecting that they ought to ally with the Spaniards and trusting that the Spaniards were opposed to Montezuma and the Aztecs. The cavalry was a great help, but they could not use the cannon or musket. It was all hand-to-hand combat. Let us read of the outcome. Just over 300 Spanish soldiers defeated some 30,000 of the finest warriors in Mexico, almost entirely with swords and crossbows. By any standard, it was an extraordinary feat of arms. The 45 dead Spanish soldiers were buried deep, lest their bodies would be dug up and defiled in the pagan rituals. Cortes now was allied with the surrendering Tlaxcalan Indians. A martial republic of 150,000 families. He was joined by 6,000 Tlaxcalan warriors. He's got a bit of a sizable troop now to continue on towards Tenochtitlan. He next went to a town called Cholula. The Cholula Indians pretended that they would ally with Cortes. However, they had had a long-standing disagreement with the Tlaxcalan Indians, so they insisted that the Tlaxcalan Indians remain outside Cholula. Cortes and his Spanish soldiers come inside the city alone. 3,000 Cholulan Indians then, on the next morning, fully armed, appeared to be prepared to ally with Cortez. Cortez had been warned through Donna Marina, gaining word that it was a plot, an ambush. Cortez came before the 3,000 armed Cholulan Indians, shamed them for their deceitfulness, and told them that the Tlaxcalan Indians were more honorable in having faced him in open battle, and therefore the Cholulan Indians must battle the Spaniards. The battle raged for 2 hours before the Tlaxcalan Indians managed to gain entrance into the city, joining in the fight, which continued for another 3 hours. 6,000 Cholulan Indian warriors were killed. Needless to say, Cortez and his army are gaining quite a reputation, which by now is spreading even as far as the Yucatan. Cortez continued on. He inquired of the routes towards Tenochtitlan, one route going by the south of Lake Chalco, as he is continuing his march from Cholula to Tenochtitlan. Another route goes through mountain passes, through dense forest, an unused road. Needless to say, he chose the unused road. Through the mountain passes, one of which was a volcano, which was erupting at the time of their passage. As they came within 1 day's journey to Tenochtitlan, at night there were some suspicious individuals stalking about the Spanish camp, and so Cortez ordered that any suspicious intruder should be shot and killed, and some were. In fact, the sentinels were so dutiful in fulfilling their orders that the Castilian crossbowman Martin Lopez nearly shot Cortez, who was on a night watch. "Next time, sir, do speak from a longer distance." Cortez continued to Tenochtitlan. The tribal council advised that Cortez be permitted to come into the city. Tlalocleel was the principal priest. However, in 1440, the Aztecs rose up and requested an emperor. An emperor was Montezuma II, now was the fifth emperor of Tenochtitlan. But the emperor really was subject to a 10-man Indian tribal council who did the bidding of the pagan priests. So really the pagan priests were the ones who were in charge. In fact, three times Tlalocleel was invited to be elected as the emperor and declined, as he said, "I am already king," because he had the greatest power as the pagan priest. Coming into Tenochtitlan by one of the causeways, the principal causeways, Cortez was greeted by Montezuma, and he explained to Montezuma of the Christian faith. Montezuma wished to hear no more of it, but took some days to show Cortez the sights of the city. Let us read from Trials and Triumphs of the Catholic Church in America. In a tower they beheld two hideous figures, seated on an altar under a canopy. One had a broad face, wide mouth, and terrible eyes. The other had a countenance like that of a bear. Before these idols were burning 8 real hearts of men, who had that day been sacrificed. The walls were black with clotted blood. The stench was sickening. In short, it was a sight awful and revolting. And Cortez did not attempt to conceal his just and Christian indignation. The Spaniards marched back to their quarters, sickened and saddened, but somewhat enlightened as to the nature and the barbarous customs of the men by whom they were surrounded. The Spaniards were indeed in a predicament, because the Tlaxcalan Indians had advised them not to go into Tenochtitlan, where the pagan priests could at any time order the drawbridges to be raised. Tenochtitlan would become a citadel, and they would be able to totally annihilate the Spaniards. Cortez needed to maintain respect of the Indians as being superior, and so he obliged Montezuma to come and take up residence in the Spanish quarters of the city. And this continued for 6 months. For 3 months, Cortez was able to stop the human sacrifice. Finally, Montezuma addressed Cortez. "I pray you, take your departure from this, my city and my land, for my gods are very angry that I keep you here. Ask of me what you want, and I will give it to you. Do not think that I say this to you in any jest, but very much in earnest. Therefore, fulfill my desire, that so may it be done, whatever may occur." Cortez agreed to go back to Veracruz. However, his ships were destroyed. He would require assistance rebuilding the ships, and he saw to it that they were built very slowly, hoping that divine providence would certainly turn the course of events in order to allow the conversion of the Indians with the conquest of the Aztec Empire. The attitude of Montezuma became hostile from this point on. Now, word came that another expedition had landed at Veracruz under General Narvaez, sent by Governor Diego Velasquez of Cuba to supplant Cortez. General Narvaez was instructed to take over authority. He had 80 cavalry, 800 men, 10 or 12 cannon, and he sent word to Montezuma for Montezuma to join with him against Cortez. General Velasquez of Cuba was acting in defiance of the Audiencia, which was the Spanish governing council for the New World in Santo Domingo on Hispaniola. Cortez left some of his troops in Tenochtitlan under General Alvarado with 70 soldiers, and he went back to Veracruz, attacking General Narvaez's troops at night with a surprise, bold attack, and quickly, within an hour, the attack was over. General Narvaez's troops were not able to use the cannon at night, and they quickly overtook the sentinels. The soldiers of Narvaez saw that Cortez had the rightful claim and the military superiority. They allied with him. So he's prepared to march back to Tenochtitlan. Two Tlaxcalan Indians in Tenochtitlan at the Spanish quarters have managed to escape Tenochtitlan, swimming to the shore in order to warn Cortez that in his absence, the Aztec Indians had decided that now it was the time to strike against Alvarado and the remaining Spanish soldiers in Tenochtitlan, now that the Spanish army was divided. So Cortez needed to march back to Tenochtitlan in order to regroup with Alvarado and the soldiers there. Prior to having left Tenochtitlan, within the time of the 6 months, Cortez had built two ships, two brigantines, on Lake Texcoco. The Aztecs burned these in order to cut off any escape. Cortez came back on the feast of St. John the Baptist, and he entered into Tenochtitlan in absolute silence, everything in foreboding. He regrouped with Alvarado and the soldiers there, and there continued to be now attacks day after day. On one day, the Indians seized the combined Spanish forces, wounding Cortez and 80 men. The following day, the Indians attacked en masse, their ranks closing and continuing on, assault after assault, against the Spanish artillery. On the third day, Montezuma himself attempted to stop the bloodshed, speaking to his Indians in caring words, asking them to cease the attack. For a moment, a murmur ran through the crowd, and then a shower of stones and arrows. Chief Montezuma fell, mortally wounded. He died 3 days later, being assisted in death by the encouragement of Cortez, the chaplain, and officers. The Indians continued the assault, 500 warriors firing upon the Spanish quarters from a nearby temple. Cortez realized that he had to gain the height of the nearby temple. Twice he sent his most select officers, who were not able, with a band of soldiers, to gain the height of the temple. Finally, Cortez himself personally attacked the height of the temple. The Indians all around through the surrounding city could see the battle as the Spanish soldiers gained the height of the temple, set everything on the height of the temple on fire, some of the priests themselves being consumed in the flames. And Cortez now called for the Indians to request peace, to spare themselves from further bloodshed if they should attempt to regain the higher ground. But the Indians declared that they would sooner have 25,000 Indians die to kill one Spanish soldier. They reminded the Spaniards that the bridges and sections of the causeways were destroyed. Their food and water was running low. Cortez realized that he had to descend the temple, regroup with the Spanish soldiers in their quarters, and make an escape from the city. The night that they escaped from the city, earlier that night, was the night Montezuma died. At midnight, they attempted an escape from the city, carrying a portable bridge to reach over the section of the bridge which was destroyed. They managed to cross over the first destroyed section of bridge. It was a totally dark night, clouds having rolled in. However, by 10 o'clock, it had started to rain, and so the causeway was very slippery. By now, the Spaniards and the retreating Tlaxcalan Indians were sighted. A sound from the sentinels was raised. Indians attacked on both sides of the causeway in canoes, shooting upon the Spanish soldiers and Indians retreating. Coming to the last section of the bridge, finding it impassable, Cortez found a shallow area of the lake and proceeded with the cavalry, leading his foot soldiers to shore. He then returned to the rear of the retreating troops, and there was Alvarado, 7 Spaniards and 8 Tlaxcalans, all covered with blood. Alvarado amazingly leapt his horse over the gap. They reached the other side for who survived. They marched for 4 miles, coming to a temple and a house, which they fortified for their night's camp. Later, the temple would become a church under the title Nuestra Señora de los Remedios, Our Lady of Refuge, who would become the patroness of the Spaniards in Mexico. One of the soldiers buried an 11-foot statue of Our Lady, which was found 20 years later. All artillery was lost. 46 horse, 870 Spaniards, 4,000 Indian allies, the son and 2 daughters of Montezuma also were killed. Seeing the loss of life, Cortez sat upon a stone and wept. This night retreat, with its terrible loss of life, became known as Noche Triste, the Night of Sorrows. They marched under constant attack and with little food. They had 46 miles to go to reach Tlaxcala, where they would be welcomed by their Indian allies. Cortez always remained resourceful and intrepid to the last. Coming up to a mountain, they looked down into the valley below the valley of Otumbra, and saw there a vast army of Aztecs as far as the eye could see, between them and Tlaxcala. We read from Trials and Triumphs of the Church in America. Even Cortez, as he contrasted the tremendous array before him with his own diminished squadrons, wasted by disease and enfeebled by hunger and fatigue, could not escape the conviction that his last hour had arrived. But this was not the heart to quail before danger, and he gathered strength from the very extremity of his situation. He addressed a few words to his troops. He reminded them of the victories they had won against fearful odds, and remarked that numbers were of no account when heaven was on their side. All then earnestly commended themselves to the protection of God, the Immaculate Virgin, and St. James. And Cortez led his brave battalions straight against the hosts of Mexico. Every man felt it must now be death or victory. The cavalry rushed into the heart of the enemy, followed by the infantry. They continued to gain assault, but wave after wave of Indians were oncoming. After several hours of battle in the heat of the day, Cortez, always looking around for an opportunity, saw the brilliantly colored plumage headdress of an Indian commander-in-chief who was directing the attack. Cortez called to Alvarado and Sandoval to join him in charge on horse. The Indians, taken by surprise, were trampled under hoof or pierced by lance. In a few moments, they came to the commander-in-chief, killed his supporters, and pierced him through with a thrown lance. Cortez seized the imperial standard, throwing it to the ground. With their leader fallen and banner thrown down, the Indians fell into general panic, and all banners were abandoned. The Indians cast down their weapons and fled in terror to the mountains with the Spaniards and Tlaxcalan Indians in pursuit. The next day, they entered the Tlaxcala territory, the land of their allies, who had warned him not to go into Tenochtitlan. But now they were reunited and greeted him warmly by the name Malinche, as they had come to call him. At last, it would seem that all that remained for him to do was retreat to Veracruz and make his escape from this land of hostility. But even now, Cortez, bold and lofty in mind, being eminent in perseverance, was still intent on returning and subjugating Mexico City and planting the cross upon the pagan towers. Within a few months, he equipped a new army and had brigantines built in separate pieces to be carried to Tenochtitlan and assembled on the lake. The day after Christmas, he reviewed the troops, 40 horse, 550 soldiers, 8 or 9 cannon with little gunpowder. He addressed the troops, reminding them that they were going to war for the glory of God and for the faith in their native land. He implored that they observe rules of good order, among which rules that no soldier should blaspheme, and he set out with 100,000 Tlaxcalans. I told my students when I was giving them the talk that this is going to be like a book report. Don't you hate it when it ends at the most exciting place and somebody says, now you got to read the book? I'm looking forward to writing articles on the Reign of Mary. And several years ago, 2003, when I did an address on the discoverers, the explorers to North America, to the New World, I left off with Magellan realizing that Cortez would be his own lecture. And in doing the research for the lecture, I came to realize, no, it's going to have to be like a 2 or 3 part series in the Reign of Mary if Father Benedict will be patient with me enough to let me go on that long. So let me conclude in simply summarizing. After an assault of 93 days, the Spanish force and the Tlaxcalan Indians gained the victory of Tenochtitlan. A few days afterwards, they captured the emperor, who was in a canoe on the lake. By then, the Spaniards had occupied all of Tenochtitlan, and so therefore, the emperor was attempting to continue some opposition, directing what little remnants of resistance there were from attacks from the lake. And so he was seized by one of the brigantines in a canoe on the lake. And so the new emperor, Cuauhtemoc, came before Cortes saying, "I have done all I could to defend myself and my people. I am now reduced to this state. You will deal with me, Malinche, as you please." But Cortes replied honorably, "Fear not, you shall be treated with all honor. You have defended your capital like a brave warrior. A Spaniard knows how to respect valor, even in an enemy." With the emperor captured, all opposition ceased. 60,000 Mexicans laid down their arms, August 13, 1521. Again, a siege of 93 days. Eyewitness gives an account of the terrible price of the assault. "It is true, and I swear, amen, that all the lakes and the houses and the barracans were full of the bodies and heads of dead men, so that I do not know how I may describe it. For in the streets and in the very courts, we could not walk except among the bodies and heads of slain Indians." Father Olmedo addressed the troops, reminding them to conduct themselves as Christians, that God may continue to bless them. He headed a procession of thanksgiving with Mass and the Litany of Our Lady, carrying a cross and displaying the image of Our Lady, concluding with a Mass of thanksgiving. Thank you very much.